talking to you today will be entitled A Framework for the Study of Scattering Amplitudes. And it's kind of a summary of the things I've been reading and considering, I guess, with the research so far, with Freddy Cochazzo, who's here working on scattering amplitudes for the most part. Okay. So I think after many weeks of field theory, we know that scattering amplitudes are important. So they contain all, scattering amplitudes for the most part contain all the relevant physics in a given cross section. I guess like everything else other than the matrix element is sort of just kinematics. So they're important, but they can be very difficult to calculate. And so the way we've been sort of learning it so far and the way it's calculated traditionally is by using Feynman diagrams, using the Feynman expansion and then summing up all the diagrams, squaring it, et cetera, et cetera. But that can be difficult for certain theories or certain situations, especially because the number of Feynman diagrams grow factorially with particle number. And so when you sort of have higher point scattering amplitudes, that might not be so practical or so enlightening. I don't know. And so I guess what the sort of the theme of this talk will be, how can you go about finding scattering amplitudes without actually summing over Feynman diagrams? What are some alternate, what is one alternate method that we could use to calculate, to write down a clean expression for the amplitudes without having to rely on this kind of this messy formalism? Right. So I guess like, so as I said, the main idea that I'll be presented in this presentation will be the idea to compute the amplitude as an integral over the Riemann surface, as opposed to an integral over the kinematic configuration space. And so this idea was kind of first proposed by Edward Witten in a paper in 2004. It was not exactly in this form, but then over time it was refined and added to and then edited and developed by others, including Dr. Cochazzo, to the form that it is today, I guess. And so you could think of an endpoint scattering amplitude as a sum over Feynman diagrams of individual diagram amplitudes, or the way that it's considered here is by a sum over puncture configurations over an n-punctured Riemann surface, where n corresponds to the number of external points. So does everybody kind of know what a Riemann surface is? Okay, so Riemann surface is basically just a complex plane with a point at infinity, and so you can think of it as a complex sphere, S2, embedded in three-dimensional space. I think we learned like a while ago that like, so if you want to impose a coordinate system on it, you generally need to use at least two, because otherwise, like the top, like if you look at the stereographic projection, then the top point, one of the points will not get mapped onto the complex plane and things like that. But if you consider the complex plane plus a single point at infinity, then you can just cleanly map the whole sort of sphere onto what is known as the Riemann surface. So you can just think of it as the complex plane plus one point at infinity. So that's kind of what it is. And then the punctured a punctured Riemann sphere is basically just the Riemann surface, the complex plane plus the point at infinity, with a couple of endpoints removed from it, or in this case, like with a Dirac delta function located at n different points. So that's kind of how you can think about it. Yeah.
So here, when you talk about this identification, is it true at only tree level, or is it true at any level?
So this is true at tree level. Uh-oh. Yeah. So this has not been expanded to loop level yet, as far as I know. Cool. All right. So this mapping,
why Riemann surfaces? Why not higher dimensional complex?
Why Riemann surfaces? Why not higher dimensional complex? I don't know. I mean, that's how the mapping has been done. I mean, so basically, you're exchanging a number of kinematic variables, kinematic invariants, for a number of complex variables, and complex variables live on the Riemann surface. So that's kind of why, if that's satisfying. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. And so the idea is like, so you're basically, as I said, you're exchanging a number of kinematic invariants, like, you know, the dot product of momenta, exchanging that for complex numbers, for n complex numbers, and the mapping between those two I guess lists of numbers is given by what is known as the scattering equations. And so you have so they take the form that you see up on the board over there, and so as you can see like, the equations are basically polynomial, although for simplicity they have not been written in the polynomial form. So when you so basically you have n equations, and then you just summed over all b not equal to a. So that's basically how it is. And then this was shown later on, well, in 2013, to have sort of n minus three solution sets. So basically, like each you can imagine each solution set is consisting of n complex numbers ranging from sigma one to sigma n, and then there's n minus three factorial of them in any dimension. Yeah. So that was shown. So the number of solution sets obviously is still factorial here, as was the case with the Feynman diagrams, but I guess it's an alternate way of looking at things. So, yeah. SAB is the kinematic invariance. So SAB is K1 plus K2 squared, or KA plus KB squared, where K's are the external momenta.
So here you just solve for sigma.
Yeah, exactly. You just solve for sigma AB using a system of n polynomial equations. Yeah. Okay. All right. Whoops. So then you can write down the expression for the amplitude. So of course we still haven't considered talked about what theory it is we are considering here, because the scattering equations that you kind of see in the delta function inside over there just define the kinematics of it, and all the interesting physics is contained in the integrand, not the delta function. And so that kind of formula is a way to write down an endpoint scattering amplitude. So, which might be reminiscent of Feynman diagrams. I mean, Feynman diagrams also involve multiple integrals with multiple delta functions. Right. And then which kind of ends up being a sum over all solution sets, sigma A, which satisfy this. So the other point is that, I guess since it's a Riemann surface, like there is this gauge shift change you could do, where you kind of you can take all the sigma ABs and apply this transformation belonging to SL2C, which is basically the transformation you see there, where alpha, beta, gamma, delta are complex numbers, and they have and the matrix alpha, beta, gamma, delta satisfies or has a determinant one, unit determinant, and so if you apply this transformation to all of the sigma A's, then you'll see that also produces a solution to the scattering equations. And so what that means is, like, as you kind of know from a study of gauge theories, there is this gauge equivalence, this non-physical solution mathematical equivalence between the different physical descriptions. And so what that means is that that this kind of integral has to be invariant over any gauge transformation of the form SL2C. And so you kind of know how the unit volume and the delta functions transform under this SL2C transformation, which is what constrains. And so that means that, like, the whatever integrand is, the IN, has to transform in the opposite way to kind of maintain this gauge invariance. And so that puts constraints on what IN can be. And so actually, so I'll sort of go on to explain what IN looks like exactly for certain theories. But so the examples of theories for which this kind of formula has been shown to kind of work possibly is Yang-Mills, like gluon scattering diagrams, and gravity, graviton scattering diagrams. So that's kind of where those are the first theories for which this formula was proven to be useful in calculating, I think, up to like maybe 10 point amplitudes, I think, for those two theories. Yeah. On the next page, I'll sort of just show quickly. I think you guys might have seen this from Guojin's talk, but. So IN in the case of Yang-Mills looks like that, you know, IN looks like that. So for Yang-Mills, like s would equal to one, so you have like one factor of each. For gravity, s would equal two, so you would just have the reduced Pfaffian squared, something like that. Yeah, obviously the matrices are complicated, but That's just to give an idea of what the integrand would look like.
The T's here are the generators of the gauge group?
Yes, the T's here are the generators of the gauge group. Of the color group.
What's psi?
Psi. Psi is a matrix defined here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the dots, the plus dot 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 represents just all cyclic like all permutations modded out by the cyclic ordering.
So your underlying theory has both scalar Yang-Mills and graviton. So just separate that?
Yeah, so to change the theory you're considering, you just change the integrand, and that gives you, depending what the integrand IN is, that gives, that produces, that generates different scattering amplitudes for different theories.
But what will be the underlying theory? So it's like pure Young Mills and pure Bertrand and pure scaling.
For this choice of IN, it's pure Young Mills and pure gravity.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. But this one also accounts for scalars, right? So
yeah, on the next, I'll get to that in the next.
Yeah,
page.
So for scalars, what will be the, like the force carrier, or will it just be like the Yukawa interaction?
So I mean, that depends on what theory you're considering, right? So I'll give some examples of the kind of theories that they were considering, but I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of theories, a bunch of the theories like are phi to the third type theory, cubic type theories, where like the scalars interact with themselves, I think.
So if I have s equals 2, that's just graviton scattering from gravitons. If I have s equals 1, just Young Mills scattering.
Just Young Mills, yeah, exactly.
So say I want to scatter Young Mills from graviton.
So this is just particles scattering with each other. So with this, you don't mix different theories. You can't have amplitudes where different particles interact with each other. Yeah. So I think the the idea of like, so the mapping a theory to its corresponding IN hasn't quite been worked out completely yet. Like as far as I can tell, basically like what Freddy's been doing a lot is like just writing down a form for IN, seeing what kinds of amplitudes it generates, and then matching that onto a theory that's known. Right. So these are some examples of the theories that scalar theories that this amplitude formula can generate. So depending on the different choices of IN, many of which are complicated, so I didn't bother writing them down here. So the special Galileans, the Dirac-Born infeld theory, the Einstein-Maxwell scalar theory, Young-Mills scalar theory, and also the did I skip NLSM? Oh, and the nonlinear sigma model, which I guess I just abbreviated here. And the nonlinear sigma model in particular is interesting is because it's the massless case of the chiral perturbation theory effective Lagrangian, which is used to describe pions. Yeah, I think. Cool. All right. oh, there it is. Yeah. So this is the Lagrangian for the nonlinear sigma model, which is, as I said, is the massless case of pions. And so one of the ideas that I was thinking about, was like if there was a way to modify this integral to allow it to access massive theories, then you could possibly use it to calculate things in the chiral perturbation theory effective Lagrangian, which is much more realistic or relevant. Okay. Right. So the next question is like, does it work? And so, based on calculations that have been done, so the amplitude formula has been shown to match the Feynman diagram expressions for small particle numbers. So, for example, for the nonlinear sigma model, it's been verified for up to 10-point amplitudes. And so, an obvious future direction that we could take is to sort of show that it works for all higher point amplitudes, and in particular, if there's a way to do it using for all higher point amplitudes, that would be great. And so if you guys, right? Anyway. And so a very logical way you might think about, like, so based on obviously the numbers that I've given and kind of, you know, very simple way one might think about extending this to higher point amplitudes is induction. Hypothetically, if there's a way to sort of connect higher point amplitudes to lower point amplitudes, that would be very incredibly convenient. If you can show that the formula presented earlier satisfies the recursion relation, and fortunately we have a way of doing that. There are relations called the Brito-Cachazzo-Feng-Witten relations, the BCFW relations, which allows you to connect higher point amplitudes for using everything from like 3-point amplitudes to n minus 2-point amplitudes. Yeah, and so the idea behind that is sort of to take the tree level diagram and to separate it into smaller pieces connected by a propagator, and then you just sum over all different ways of factorizing the diagram into two smaller pieces, and so that's what the formula basically looks like for gluon scattering, and then similar formulas have been suggested for other scalar theories, and others.
Is it obvious that only the number of points amplitudes are there, right?
Oh, so the reason why for these even numbers are valid is because this nonlinear signal model amplitudes vanish when the outer points are not even. Yeah, and so the odd ones are just zero. So I mean, I guess they're verified in that sense. Yeah. Cool. All right.
And that's, then the previous slide has this beautiful relationship that works not just for the nonlinear signal model, so it actually works for all sorts of numbers.
Yeah. So this formula works for Yang-Mills particle scattering. And then there's a different formula for a nonlinear signal model, but it doesn't look as nice, so I didn't put it up. Yeah.
So are you saying the scattering amplitudes for odd number of external particles is zero in the nonlinear signal model? People just know that that's aside from all this formalism?
Yep, that's
so, but so have they verified that you also get zero?
Yep. I don't know why I only put 4, 6, 8, and 10. I should have just put like everything under 10, right? Like that makes much more sense. Okay. So I guess I'll... Since the BCFW relations are pretty important and they're interesting, I'll just give a very quick proof of how exactly they work. And so the idea is like, so you take all the external momenta, and then you deform it in some complex way, so you can multiply it by some complex factor, or you know something like that. And then you just write down an expression a n of z. And the only thing which is supposed to represent the endpoint scattering amplitudes that are trying to solve for. And the only thing you need to know is that like when z goes to zero, like that all the momenta return to their undeformed state, which means a n of zero would be just the original original amplitude that you're looking for. And then so you consider this this contour integral, this contour integral of a n of z over z, like at around like all space. And so if a n scales well at large z, basically if a n scales at least I forgot the dz, but if a n of z is goes at least as 1 over z, then that integral is 0, which means you can do fun things with it. And so basically, so that means 0 equals a n of z. So one pole is at z equals 0. And so that gives you the amplitude that you want to find. And then there's all these other amplitudes. And if you think about where poles in the amplitude might come from, like they're the places where the propagator goes on shell, right? And so basically, you're summing over all possible values of z that make the propagators go on shell, and those are all the factorization channels that you're considering. And so this obviously separates. So doing it this way, like considering the poles at the propagators, basically breaks up the tree level factor diagram into a side to the left of the propagator and side to the right of the propagator, and it just sum over all the residues from all the places where the propagator goes on shell. So, yeah. So, I think this result was a few years back. And so the point is that like so with these recursion relations, we might be able to use induction to prove the Cochazzo-He-Yuan integral formula that was presented earlier. Yeah.
I couldn't see a connection after you show that an is equal to residues. How would it connect to like the recursion relation? Like I couldn't see the connection.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Here you just show that an is equal to
the residue. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But how? Why this one equals to that recursion relation?
Oh, so. Right. So the residues, so the poles at z prime, right, or z star, are located at the places where the propagators of the internal propagator lines go on shell, because the propagator always looks like 1 over p squared, right? One over the momentum of the line squared, right?
Oh, so you assume that p equals to 1 over p equals to z
over. Whatever momentum is flowing through the internal line is going to be in terms of the external momenta, right? And the external momenta is complexified, and so the internal propagator will also have a momentum that's complexified as well.
Okay.
And so when that goes on shell, like that's when the amplitude will have a pole.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you write this down, so basically like you can kind of I guess you can kind of see it, but like you have the if you think about summing up all the Feynman diagrams, you have the Feynman diagrams where like that particular propagator, that particular combinations of the external momenta goes on shell, and you have all the ones where it doesn't, right? Where you have all the ones where like that particular combination of external momenta does not appear in the Feynman diagram, right? And so in all the ones that where it does not appear, like the residue will just be zero because there's no pole there. And at the Feynman diagrams where the propagator does appear, that's where you'll have the poles, and that'll be the residues. That'll be the Feynman diagrams that you're summing over, right?
So can I understand this as like your amplitude equals to like you sum over all the possible sum over all the lines? And
yeah.
Which you set the lines to be on shell and then
yeah.
Just the two separate.
Like, yeah, and then you separate it into two smaller on shell amplitudes.
Oh, okay. So like for example, it can be separated to 2 point and 3 point.
Yeah.
But there are like so many ways of separating. And three. So you have to sum over all this possible.
There aren't. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, in the original, in Yang-Mills, for example, what you can do is like, so you don't have to deform all the momenta, right? You can deform just two. So you say, for example, So suppose you only deform two momenta, right? And so then basically there are only like there's a linear number of ways you can cut the diagram, assuming the diagram is like color ordered. Assuming the diagram is like, yeah, has been ordered properly, so you're only allowing cyclic permutations, which is a whole other thing.
So in general, that you don't need to set every P to be compensable. You can just set like several. And then
you can do different things.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
If you like. Yeah.
So just to get to your first line, complex information. All your momenta are parameterized by a single complex value. Is that?
Yes.
Okay, why?
Well, because you only want to take the contour and integral over one complex plane, as opposed to multiple. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's only a function of zeta and zeta?
No. It's only
a
function.
Holomorphic?
So I guess it is holomorphic. I don't know what the significance of that would be, but. I mean, it's differentiable, I guess. Complex differentiable, yeah. Right. Okay. Cool. Right. So why recursion relations? For the formula, the integral formula I presented earlier, the CHY representation or the CHY formalism enables us a very easy study of soft limit amplitudes. And so if you remember the integrand, the expressions for the integrand from earlier, suppose that, you know, if supposing we were to say take one of the momenta to zero. So we take the one of the external momenta multiplied by some factor like tau, and then take tau to go to zero. So the way that the formula is set up is makes it very easy to sort of figure out what exactly is a scaling behavior of the amplitude as the one or two or more of the momenta go to zero at some rate. So here's a table from one of Cachazzo and his peers' papers about how the amplitudes scale as you multiply one in the single soft case or two in the double soft case of the external momenta, and you multiply by some linear factor tau and then set and then have tau go to zero, and then this is kind of how the amplitudes scale. And so because the CHY formalism makes it very easy to study like continuously transitioning from like a higher point amplitude to a lower point amplitude, the hope is that maybe like there's an easy way to connect them and an easy way to sort of see how the recursion relations might be satisfied. As you guys might remember, the recursion relations from the previous page relied on everything from n minus 2 down for an endpoint scattering amplitude. So there might be some connection there. Yeah. OK. No more questions? Right. So conclusions and future directions. So the CHY formalism presents a unified framework in which to compute scattering amplitudes. As you kind of saw, like it's simpler. Nicer way of calculating the scattering amplitudes rather than using the transfer matrix formalism, which we've been using in QFT and the standard model thus far. So a proof for all endpoint functions can proceed by possibly by induction. And then, of course, another direction in which we might want to look at it is trying to make it work for massive cases. And so thus far, if you remember, all the theories that have been shown to be applicable to the CHY formalism have been massless, like Yang-Mills gravity, et cetera, et cetera. And so if there's a way to make it work for massive theories, like, for example, if you're able to like add mass to the nonlinear sigma model, and then you might be able to use that to calculate amplitudes for pion scattering or something like that, which would be cool. Yeah. So thank you.
So we have 7 minutes for questions.
So you're looking for a Higgs mechanism for this?
Maybe. Yeah.
We'll go back to two slides.
Yeah.
So it looks like two of these amplitudes diverge in the double soft limit.
Yeah.
Comment on the significance.
That's a good question. So I haven't had a chance to study the Einstein-Maxwell scalar theory and the Yang-Mills scalar theory that closely, so I'm not quite sure how the about the behavior of the amplitudes at the soft limits.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I think I lost track. You must have mentioned that. What's the NND for double soft?
I'm sorry?
There is a parenthesis.
Oh, I'm sorry. I actually did not mention that. So n stands for like non-degenerate, like d stands for degenerate. Like it has to do with like which external particles you take to go simultaneously to zero. I guess it matters like whether they're like adjacent or non-adjacent. Like once they have been ordered up to some cyclic permutation. And so if they are adjacent like external momenta, then it's in the degenerate case. If they're non-adjacent, then it's the non-degenerate case.
Could you go back to the last slide,
the conclusion page?
The last slide? This slide? Yeah,
this slide.
So what is that
sage PT? That's the chiral perturbation theory, Lagrangian. And so that is used to describe chiral theories with scalars, massive scalars. The Lagrangian looks something along the lines of this one right here, except it has a mass. I don't know, like that's what I would like to find out.
Okay, let's thank our speaker once again.
Okay, good afternoon. This work was done a couple of years back under the National Initiative for Undergraduate Studies of Physics in India. So I know probably the title is very obscure, but hopefully we'll understand it by the end of the talk. So let's start with something basic that we've done in the quantum theory core course. We've learned about quantum teleportation, and let's just recall the process. It's a four-step process. So say Alice has some system, say a half-spin system, that she wants to teleport to Bob. So and say Alice and Bob share an EPR pair. So the first step is Alice does some measurement on her qubit of the EPR pair and her system. And she classically communicates with Bob. And conditional on what Alice measures, Bob will perform some measurement on his EPR qubit. And he will be able to get the same state that Alice had before. And the state at Alice's end collapses, so there's no cloning happening here. And this was done in 1993 by Bennett. So let's look at the timeline for quantum teleportation. It was done in 93. It was extended in 94 by Weidman to continuous variables, which is something that's important for the talk. And it was also experimentally realized soon after. So these are some references if you want to go down that lane. But we will be talking about, today we will be talking about remote tomography, which is essentially just teleportation, but for continuous variables because you want to reconstruct the density matrix, so you need an ensemble of states to be teleported before you can get the density matrix back, just by the nature of it being a continuous variable that you want to reconstruct. So, and something called entanglement swapping also happens in.
Question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a remote tomography and just tomography? Is it the same for all purposes?
No. So if you have some state, you can do tomography on it, but only if you can do some interaction with the original state and be able to send your particles, then only you can do remote tomography. But it's essentially similar, yes. So, and there's something called entanglement swapping. So if we go back to the teleportation picture, if Alice had phi entangled with some state psi initially, then it turns out that the teleported photon or teleported state Bob has would also be entangled with the original phi, even if they have never interacted in the past. So that's entanglement swapping. So you've swapped it from one particle to another. OK. So the question then is, can we extend this for something called for some variables which are non-commuting, like canonical variables like position and momentum? And the answer is yes, which is why I'm giving this talk. And we will talk about this, but let's go through some miscellaneous topics to be able to understand that. So first we'll talk about some indirect measurements. So again, from our quantum theory core course, let's recall the von Neumann indirect measurement. And essentially what you're doing is instead of doing measurements on your system itself, you entangle it with an ancilla and you do measurements on the ancilla. So it's non-destructive in the sense. So if you go back to our quantum foundation course lectures, it's the second type of detector we have effectively. So there's a paper by Arthurs and Kelly in 65 where they extended this to ancilla system to do a joint measurement on your system to get information for both position and momentum. So essentially, instead of your one ancilla you had before, now you have two ancillas that are prepared in a specific state so that you can find some information. But because your variables, position and momentum variables, are non-commuting, you can only find out information to some extent. The Hamiltonian they consider is some constant with K, with Q and P are the original system variables. P1 and P2 refer to the momentum operators for detector 1 or ancilla 1 and detector 2, ancilla 2. So essentially, because your momentum operators are generators for translations, your ancilla counter measurement counters X1 and X2 will have some shifts which you can measure off. It's not so simple because it's non-commuting. Otherwise, it's fairly straightforward. Okay. And before we proceed again, we will talk about something called quantum tracking. So the concept of quantum tracking is exactly what I've been talking about in the last two slides, where you have an interaction between your system and ancilla, say, and some observable for your ancilla has the same expectation value that your system had initially. So then, by definition, it's said that the apparatus of observable is tracking the system observable. So we want to track the position and momentum observables for our initial system and find some tracking observable of our ancilla system. Okay. But before we proceed, because of the non-commuting nature of position and momentum, we have to consider into account the disturbance cause when you're doing a joint measurement that is over and above your intrinsic Heisenberg uncertainty relation, which is just H good by 2. So Arthurs and Goodman proved a lower bound for the disturbance you should find in your ancilla observable system. And it's, as you can see, instead of H good by 2, it becomes H good. So this is the best case scenario. And this is important just to mention that irrespective of teleportation or tomography, this is something that has to be obeyed irrespective of whatever procedure you're doing with your system. Okay. And finally, if we are able to find an interaction with the system and ancilla states, and we do send these ancillas remotely to Bob, say, he has to do tomography on them. And there are a number of methods, but the most important is through the Wigner function. So let's talk about the Wigner function. It's a quasi-probability distribution because it is negative. So at certain points, it's not always positive, and that's why you're going to call it a proper probability distribution function. But at the same time, it has some nice properties. Like if you trace out the momentum from the Wigner function, you'll get the marginal for your position. So that's phi x squared. And similarly, if you trace out position, you get the marginal for p, which is phi p square in Fourier space after Fourier transform. Okay, so this is just an example of a Wigner function for the third excited state for the harmonic oscillator. You can see, so asymptotically, it's going to zero. So you can see it's going negative at multiple points. And a nice feature of the Wigner function is if you coarse grain it enough, you will get the classical probability distribution. So it becomes positive after you coarse grain it. So the negativities are always small. So the idea with the Wigner function is if you are able to reconstruct the Wigner function from your ancilla system, you can easily do tomography on it. Okay, so going back to the Arthur Skelly measurement interaction. So we talked about the Hamiltonian before, but now we'll also go and talk about what they tried to find out. So they considered detector states which were Gaussian, and that makes sense because you want your initial states to be less disturbed so that they can take a lot of information, as much information as they can from your system. So, but they chose these two detectors such that they are a one-parameter family defined by B. So only one of them can do a sharp measurement at a time, or you can have one sharp, other sharp, or like somewhere in the middle where you are able to achieve your lower bound for your uncertainties. So they did the interaction. So you have your Hamiltonian. Your initial state is a tensor product. So you just apply your unitary operator on the system and then trace out the system. So you have a probability distribution in terms of your detector 1 and detector 2, which here are y and z. And they showed that you can recover the marginals for either x or p. If you take b to 0 or infinity, you cannot do that at the same time. And the uncertainty principle, like the uncertainties are increased due to the measurement in the following way. But they achieve the lower bound when b is equal to root half. So that was what they did. And what we try to do is we try to extend the same protocol, but we try to do it for different detector states. We had a one-parameter system B. Here we generalize it to B1 and B2. So essentially, you have the same similar Arthur Skelly kind of interaction, and then you trace out the system and you send the two. Say if the ancillas are photon, you can send it far away, and you can do tomography remotely. So So these are just the same detector states as the Arthur scale E1, except for B goes to B1 and B2. And now we do the same procedure. You apply the unitary on your initial tensor product state. So you have your Ancilla, and system. And here you have the commutator term commutes with each term, so you can apply it successively. And the details are not so important, but here we, so another important thing about the interaction is we kind of consider it as an impulsive interaction. So you do not take into consider the other Hamiltonian, like the normal Hamiltonian, and you just consider the interaction Hamiltonian acting for a short time, such that kT equals to 1. And after you have this, you have your state, which you need to now trace the system out of. And after you've traced your system out, you have your density matrix for your apparatus, the two Ancillas, that is. And you have now the modified uncertainties that are there for x1 and x2 because we generalized B to B1 and B2. And now the idea is after you have this apparatus density matrix, you want to find some observable that is Hermitian, and so that you can recover the marginals for position and momentum for your system. And you can do that. And here, the form is in such sense that you can see its Hermitian easily. And you have Y and Z tracking Q and P respectively for your initial system. Though X1 and X2 are commuting variables, Y and Z are not. So that's the result that is subsequent of the fact that you're trying to find, trying to track non-commuting variables. Okay. And similarly, you can show that you can recover the Wigner function with B1 going to 0 and B2 going to infinity, which is just having the Gaussian detectors going to delta functions, essentially. And but to reconstruct the Wigner function, you need different slices. So what I mean by that is if you have your QP plane, you have to recover marginals for QP as well as linear combinations of Q and P so that you have information along different axes that you can use to reconstruct your Wigner function. And that can be done because the Hamiltonian has a symmetry. So if you simultaneously rotate QP, P1 and P2 by theta, you can do this. But now the problem is you need different detectors to do subsequent slices. And to overcome that, you can choose B1 and B2 to be half, which is very different from the Arthur Skelly case where B1 equals to B2, essentially. So here you can take this case and you can show that because of the symmetry of the Hamiltonian and the detector states, you can recover the Wigner function because you can recover any linear combination of Q and P is marginal. And essentially you get back the density matrix by inverse Radon transform on your Wigner function. Okay. This is just an example. So this is the same state, the third excited state for the harmonic oscillator that I showed you the Wigner function for. And because the Wigner function is essentially a one-parameter system because it's symmetric about rotationally symmetric, you can plot it along under root of q squared plus p squared, which is just the distance. And here we have plotted A is the Wigner function itself. B is the reconstructed Wigner function for B1 equals to 0.1. So as B1 goes to 0, it'll match the Wigner function itself. C is the difference between the curves A and B. And D is a worse reconstruction with a worse detector with B1 equals to 0.3. And C is the Arthur Skelly probability distribution, which is just the Hissimi function. And it's always positive, you will see. So That's just an example. And I've reached my conclusion. So we are able to show a novel method for, instead of a four-step teleportation method, it's a two-step remote tomographic method where you can track position as well as momentum. And it doesn't, so the no cloning theorem is obeyed because the initial system does not have this information anymore. And the Arthurs-Goodman relations that we talked about are also obeyed because, as I said, X1 and X2, though are commuting, the observables, the measurement observables are not. And so measurements on single photon have been done using optical homodiming, balanced optical homodiming. And to do this for two photons, it seems feasible, though people haven't done it yet. So that's something that hopefully maybe experimentalists can try looking at. And that's more or less it. I didn't understand, sorry.
So in normal teleportation, Alice makes her measurement in the bell bases on her system, and then she has to convey that classical information to Bob for him
So here we don't have classical communication. So Alice locally does some operations on the ancilla and the system, and she sends these ancillas to Bob. And that can be done because the ancillas can be photons in the telecom frequency, and they can be sent in optical fibers without much absorption.
So if Alice can just send her state to Bob, why doesn't she just do that and get to do regular tomography?
Because it could be various reasons. The initial state could have a decay time, and it could it may not be feasible to send it via a classical channel.
Oh, so she's only sending the ancilla to Bob?
She's only sending
that.
She's
not sending her.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, and then Bob just makes a measurement on the ancilla.
Yeah, the two ancillas together.
And interesting.
So there's no EPR pairs. It's slightly different.
The two ancillas are entangled to begin with, right?
In the beginning, no. But after the interaction, they are, yes.
Okay, so yeah, you don't need shared entanglement, but you need to be able to communicate. You need
Yes, you do, you do. And like this is also hinted by the original paper by Bennett where he describes his teleportation method. But at that time, probably such classic quantum channels weren't widespread.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, if there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again.
So just to explain the title real quickly, ab initio is Latin from the beginning. In this context, a better translation would probably be like first principles. And holographies versus holograms, which are 3D images encoded on a 2D surface. So the basic idea is that you have one higher dimension, which is the information content actually just lives in one lower dimension. And so this is, of course, referring to the...
It's like one higher dimension to lower dimension to lower dimension to lower dimension, so everything gets to a point. That's what you said, from the higher dimension minus one dimension. Then they can just do the same process again, 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 and you will reach to like zero dimension, so all the information can be on the point. That can't be right.
Well, like a hologram is like, you have a hologram that I'm familiar with is you have like a 2D glass film, and you can shine a laser through it, so it projects an image out. And if you sketch the glass just right, it'll look like a 3D image. Or you also have these stickers that you kind of tilt to get a 3D effect, even though it's a 2D sticker. So,
yeah.
Okay, so the overview of my talk. I'm reviewing this paper here at the bottom by Peter Luntz, Sung-Sik Lee, and others. A called ab initio holography. And basically, the outline of the paper is that they applied a quantum renormalization group, which is introduced in this paper by Sung-Sik Lee, to construct holographic dual of a lattice model in particular. So this paper here by Sung-Sik is, he introduces the quantum renormalization group more generally, and he shows that if you start with a matrix field theory, so a quantum field theory in which the fields are matrices, and you apply a quantum renormalization group, which is a special version of just a conventional renormalization group, you can recover the Einstein-Hilbert action and get conventional GR, classical GR. So here we're just going to apply it to a concrete lattice model, just to see what we can learn about condensed matter systems, low energy systems. And so in particular, we're going to show that we can use the results of this quantum renormalization group to characterize the different phases that will appear in the lattice model. So the lattice model itself lives on the called the UV boundary, which is just kind of a surface in ADS space, I guess. And so the main point of the paper is that you can use the geometry, and more particularly the locality or non-locality of the quantum renormalization group flow in this higher dimensional space to kind of characterize what the phases of the lattice system. So that was pretty abstract, so more concrete. So this is the model we're going to be studying. It's a quantum field theory given by this action in D dimensions. And so these phis are they're vectors of n bosons, so each element of the list is a certain type of flavor of boson, and there's n types. And so you can, from statistical mechanics, you can calculate the critical exponents perturbatively in this large n limit. But the reason this model is not completely trivial is that you're not really able to use Wilsonian conventional renormalization group to calculate the beta functions, for example, this lambda, how it changes the different energy scales. Because if you try to do that, you apply renormalization group, you'll see that you'll generate more operators, so the action doesn't map back onto itself. And so if you just keep applying renormalization group, you get more and more operators. And so it's not really feasible to use Wilsonian RG to calculate the beta functions. And some work by string theorists using the ADS-CFT correspondence, this model is believed to be dual to a higher spin gauge theory. So I just Googled this briefly, and it's really complicated. But from what I understand, I guess in certain models of quantum gravity, if you try to add particles of higher than spin 2, then you're forced to include particles of all spin. So this higher spin gauge theory is studying how you can, I think, write terms in Lagrangian that will describe the...
just a brief question. So why can't we use Wilsonian renormalization group to calculate beta function? But we can do epsilon expansion.
Yeah, I'm not really sure on the details. I asked Sung-Sik about this, and his reply was just that if you try to apply Wilsonian RG, you don't get the action doesn't map it back onto itself with different coupling coefficients. You actually get more operators.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So in some models of, well, I'm going to show that explicitly in a little bit, that you get more operators, mm-hmm. and we'll deal with that.
Which dimension you
have? This is just general dimension D.
Isn't this dimension, like,
This duality?
I mean, whether you can apply
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. In the paper, this is stated in general, so I would I think it might be general, but... So the units of the coupling constants will depend on the dimension, but I think the fact that you generate more operators mm-hmm. is independent of the dimension. Yeah.
Okay, but you always generate more operators if you do renormalization, right? So
the renormalization group, you have some space of coupling constants, and you try to make your renormalization scheme in such a way that you're flowing entirely in that space of the action just with different coupling constants. I don't think that's possible here.
But what is almost always done is like you do your renormalization computational operation, and they project it back into the theory space, and they get, you know, artificially almost like the same kind of shape. But you just say, the stuff I'm projecting down on, it's like, those are irrelevant coupling, so I don't care about those.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm not exactly sure what he means precisely by this statement. It's not really important for the conclusions of the paper. The idea is this is a nice toy model to study quantum renormalization group. So my very limited knowledge of higher spin gauge theory is that in some models of quantum gravity, you try to incorporate particles of spin higher than 2, and that forces you, for some reason, to include particles of all types of spin. And so the higher spin gauge theory just refers to the fact that you're trying to put extra fields in your Lagrangian that will determine the dynamics of the gauge fields. And so it's they're theorized here is because ADS CFT corresponds, of course, not proven. This is a basic overview. So the next step we do is we take this continuum model, and we regularize it by putting on a lattice with some lattice spacing A. So there's some minimum lattice spacing, and that's essentially equivalent to a upper momentum cutoff, because if you have a shortest length scale, then you have a highest momentum that you can have. So these two terms are essentially the same. That's just the mass term. This is the quartic term that we had from before. And this hopping term is related to the kinetic term, that nabla phi squared. So if you expand this, if you assume like the lattice spacing is very small, you can expand. So I and J here refer to the site in the lattice and not to the components of the flavor. So phi I has in components, each phi I. So I is referring to the lattice site. So if you expand phi j around phi I, then the first term will just be another phi I, and that will affect this mass term. And then the next term will give you this kinetic term. I think the first derivative term vanishes. But basically, this comes from the kinetic term. And these tij are called hopping parameters because you can think of this operator as destroying a particle at the site j and then creating a site I, so it's hopping from j to I. And this is basically a generalization of the Bose-Hubbard model to n flavors, so these are bosons. And it has a symmetry group un, so you can rotate these by unitary matrices, and this action is preserved. And of course, the identity matrix is in here, so the negative of the identity matrix is also in here. And that negative identity corresponds to the Z2 symmetry in an Ising model where you just flip every spin. So the Z2 symmetry of the typical Ising model is a subset of this. So this model has a phase transition corresponding to sufficiently large t, because if you think of the tii term, the sum over ij includes I equal to j. And so you think of the ii term, well, that will be grouped here. And so you can imagine this as a field theoretic description of a Ising model, which from Landau-Ginzburg we know to have a stable model with a phase transition, you need a quartic term that's like the curving up. And the sign, how depending on how large this is compared to TII is compared to the M, you either have a downward, you get a 2D Mexican hat. So this has a phase transition depending on the magnitude of the hopping parameter. So this is basically supposed to be a schematic diagram for that. For low TIJ, it's called insulating because this is has interpretation of hopping from site to site. And for large, it's superfluid because they're hopping around. And the superfluid phase is referred to as a symmetry broken phase, not the entire UN symmetry, but the Z2 symmetry I was talking about before, because the expected value of phi star I, phi j will be non-zero, which breaks the Z2 symmetry. Right, okay. So now we're just going to apply the normal conventional renormalization group. And the way that the scheme is set up is such that we write down the partition function as an integration over all field configurations. And so this is the field phi. And these are the parameters of the model, the mass, the hopping, and the coefficient of the quartic term. And we scale the mass up by taking m to m e to the dz. So this 2 dz comes from squaring the mass. And then we see okay, what kind of shifts do we have to do in the parameters? And also, what kind of extra action terms do we have to add to make this equivalent to the original partition function? This proportionality sign just means that we're ignoring constants because they'll drop out of physical calculations. So the reason you need this term is because it's not entirely clear that you can always recover the same action within the same, or sorry, recover the same partition function with the same form of the action. So you may need extra terms. In fact, you do. And then this line is just a definition of S1 tilde. So you're just calling all this S1 tilde. And so the physical interpretation of scaling the mass up by e to the dz is you're basically making the Gaussian part of the action have a smaller width. And so the idea of how this renormalization group scheme is going to proceed is that we're going to split this larger this field with a larger mass into two fields via, I'm not going to do that explicitly, but you split into two fields and you integrate out the one with the higher mass. So you return back to a model with the same mass.
Is that dz is the length scale of we integrate out? Like, is the length scale of the cross current?
Yeah, it's an infinitesimal step in RG. It's basically controlling how much of this mass you're integrating out. So the blue is the new one, just to be clear. Okay, so if you do that, S1 tilde is on the bottom line there. This is what you actually get from S1 tilde. Here, this mass term is the same because you integrate, you split the field into a field with the mass m and then another field which has the rest of the mass, and you integrate out. And the reason this is not m squared e 2 dz is because then you rescale the fields afterwards. And if rescaling the fields will just rescale the integration measure, which is a constant, which we ignore. So this is a busy slide, but the important parts is that this is just the reference action which controls the insulating phase, and this is a hopping term exactly from before, whose magnitude controls which phase you're in. And then these are other terms that are generated. And so as I said before, you don't get the same form of the action. You actually need that delta term. And the important thing that we're going to talk about here is that you generate terms like this, where you have even more fields. So if you kept stepping in this conventional RG, you would get even higher powers of the field. So this is a six-field term. So this has all so far just been conventional renormalization group. Right. And so we classified operators by this adjective in trace, where by in trace, I just mean there's in flavor contractions. So this would be called a single trace operator because I haven't been writing the dot so far, but when you see like phi I, phi j, that means there's a sum over the flavors involved, and the flavors just being the components. So this would be a single trace operator in this classification, and these are multi-trace operators. So this would be an in trace, this would be n plus one trace, and so on. And so basically, just the main point of the last slide is just that if you start with a theory which has only single trace operators, so the hopping term is a double trace operator, but you can see even if you don't have that, even if the TIs are zero, you still, this is not proportional TI. So you get, even if you start in the subspace of single trace operators, you still flow into a space of multi-trace operators. So this is all just conventional renormalization group. Okay, so now the novel part of the quantum renormalization group is that we return back to a theory with only single trace operators, aside from the hopping here. Aside from this quartic term, which is necessary for the phase transition. And the way we do that is this is a partition function exactly as before, and now we use this identity. We introduce two dummy variables and integrate over them, and you get this functional identity. And so basically we're just applying that to here on the, path integral level. So these these are just dummy integration variables, which are in this identity, these t's here, for some new action s1. And so this is the action s1. And you can see we've used this identity. We've applied it to all the terms that which were exponential and multi-trace operator. And so now the multi-trace operator, like the phi cube term from before, this term here becomes this term here, this T cube. So now you have exclusively, aside from the correct term necessary for the insulating phase, you could also remove this using this identity, but we don't because we want our model to be physical still. But basically, you've removed all the higher, the multi-trace terms. And the price you have to pay is you have to integrate over them, over these fields. Right. Yeah. Well, because exponentials multiply, and then they add an exponent. So the action is a sum of terms. You can apply this to, yeah. OK, so just a nice picture of this is that if, say, you start in a subspace. So this is supposed to be thought of as a space of actions or a space of theories. So if you start in a space, this plane down here, of a theory with only a single trace operator, this red line represents the conventional RG flow. And then the quantum renormalization group says, no, I'll come back down. It's like a whack-a-mole, kind of. It brings it back down. But the price you have to pay is that you have to integrate over many theories in this plane. And that's what this. So these are couplings, the same as before. The hoppings are essentially couplings, but they're dynamical now. So you have to integrate over many theories with many couplings. So the main point is the multi-trace operator equals single-trace operator dynamical couplings. And the quantum minimization group projects down the conventional RG. And so now you do the obvious thing. You just iterate this. So start with your original theory, conventional RG. Project down. You get all these theories, which are indexed by these hopping parameters or couplings labeled with a 1. Now, every single one of these, you do another round of renormalization group and project down. So, and you have, so you get an iterated series of path integrals. And the end result is that you get a path traced out, or you have many different paths traced out in this space of single trace operators, and you just integrate over them. So you take the RG step size to be infinitely small and infinitely many. And so you label the continuous RG step with this coordinate z. And this integral over iterated steps in RG becomes a path integral over these couplings indexed by the continuous RG variable z. So it's basically just like when we introduce the path integral, you have say like something like a string, which is discretized. So you have points on the string. You integrate over all configurations of each point. Now, if you take those points to be infinitely many, you're integrating over all continuous configurations of the string. So that's once you make the RG steps continuous, you're integrating over all different paths in this single trace subspace. Yeah.
So now there's an uncertainty of like what your theory looks like after renormalizing to a certain scale z.
Exactly, yeah. That's why it's called the quantum renormalization group, because the couplings are promoted to quantum variables. So you make this the RG steps continuous, and then you finally, what you get is you get integral over d phi, d phi star, and the coupling fields tij and tij star, and then you integrate out the phi, phi star. So now you just have a partition function written as an integral over the hopping fields and some bulk action, which is written here, which is also a little gory, but this is the most important term. So anything else you want to say about this? Yeah, so you interpret this as being a quantum field theory where these hopping parameters, which were previously the couplings, are now the fields. So that's why it's called quantum renormalization group, because the couplings are promoted to quantum variables. And this term is important because it has the interpretation of you. Well, actually, I'll show the next slide. So just keep that term in mind. And it becomes something like this. I've swapped the indices around, but it's the same term. So now this has the interpretation as this quantum operator deletes the JK bond. This deletes the IJ bond, so IJ, JK, and replaces them with the IK bond. So a bond between site I and site k. And so the idea is that as you flow in the quantum renormalization group, the z variable or z variable, you replace these nearest neighbor hoppings with longer range. So I just said before, also the original model is just nearest neighbor coupling. So T0ij, which is the initial hopping coupling parameters, as only connects nearest neighbor sites. But now as you flow in quantum RG, you generate longer range couplings or hoppings. And so what hoppings are possible determines the connectivity of the lattice and hence the geometry.
I'm a little bit confused about the point of this slide. So I was saying that like after an RG we get like long range coupling. Do you replace like the short range coupling by long range?
Well, you can think of this as an annihilation operator. So this will delete the, I mean, it's.
So this is the operator acting on the.
Well, so it started as a coupling parameter, which was not an operator. Then we rewrote the partition function this way. Now we say, hey, this looks like the partition function of a quantum field theory with fields Tij. And you get a term like this, which has this interpretation. Delete link, place with large link. And this is going down this way is float in Z. Okay, so the idea is, let me go back to the bulk acting real quick. So this in here is formally equivalent to 1 over h bar. If you're thinking of like a quantum field theory in Euclidean time, you get action over h bar. So there's a formal equivalence between h bar and 1 over n, n being the number of flavors in our bosons. So if you take n to be very large, that's equivalent to taking h bar to be small, and that the partition function is dominated by the semi-classical RG path, this RG path being in the single trace subspace. And so if you extremize the bulk action, which I had written before, you get these saddle point equations. And so there are infinitely many coupled first order differential equations. And a key point is that at the saddle point, even though these were originally complex conjugate of each other, they can take independent values. And that's because in this action here, you're integrating. So this integral over T and T star can be thought of as integrating over the real and imaginary parts of T star. And you're integrating the real and imaginary parts from 0 to infinity. If the action is analytic, you can deform the path that you're integrating over in the complex plane. And so the point that extremizes the bulk action could be anywhere in the complex plane. And so you can have these two hopping fields be independent at the saddle point. And let me finish this slide. There's extra terms I didn't write in the partition function. So I wrote the bulk action, which turns the dynamics, but there's also two boundary terms. One corresponds to the z equals 0 boundary, which is called the UV boundary. And essentially, that enforces that enforces this condition. If you extremize the boundary, z equals 0 boundary. And then you also have the boundary of how far in z you flow to. And so if you call that z star, that imposes another boundary condition, which ends up being this. So the Tij star at the saddle point are essentially the normalized correlation functions. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you did this integral from from 0 to infinity. Why not from minus infinity to infinity? Because I assume this is where the asymmetry comes from.
Which asymmetry?
So this is asymmetry between T star and T, right?
This is just a mathematical fact, which comes from the fact that extremizing the action could have anywhere in the complex plane. If the bulk action is analytic, you can deform the integration anywhere in the complex plane. So. And it's from 0 to infinity because we define z equals 0 to be the original lattice model.
Why is it called like bulk action? Because it's like when you say it is bulk
action. It's called a bulk action because if you do this properly, you get two other terms which are called the UV action and the IR action. So z equals 0. Z is related to this ADS scale in ADS space. It's like I think Z is like the log of the ADS scale or something. So the term you get, that's the UV action, is the Z equals zero. Because that's Z equals zero is like a small, or I guess it's like zero link scale, which is an infinite frequency. So at Z equals zero, that's the UV boundary. At Z equals Z star, that's how far you flow in quantum RG. That's called the IR boundary because that's the opposite of what I just said before. And the bulk action is, it's called a bulk because it's like the bulk, it's like a volume in ADS space, I think.
Did you get the position function after you integrated out, like phi and phi star?
Yeah, phi and phi star have been integrated out here. Yeah, you could cut off the quantum minimization group anywhere.
I mean that's the half integral, yeah.
Here?
Yeah. So do you integrate from zero to C or
this is integration over all configurations. So T is a function of which link scale you're looking at. Yeah. And this is integrating over all configurations of the hopping at different link scales. So this is the picture.
Yeah.
If you think of z as parameterizing these curves, then the path integral over of t of z is all different configurations of these curves.
Yeah, that's fine. But like when you integrate, you have to integrate over all possible, or like so you affect your initial state, but the final state will be spread out, right? So you also have to integrate over all the final.
So you're asking what's the boundary condition at the IR? Yeah.
So you have to. Pose a boundary condition, and then you can integrate.
Yeah, there is another boundary term called e to the minus n I, SIR, which I haven't written here for brevity, but that will impose a boundary condition at where you stop the RRG flow. And that corresponds at the saddle point to this condition. I just haven't written explicitly because it was already a busy slide.
Okay, let's move.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, so basically this is just, we solve these saddle point equations numerically, and this plot is just supposed to show that if you solve these saddle point equations numerically, and then you look at z equals zero, which is the original lattice model, it's the result you get, which is these blue dots, the numerics, is consistent with what we know analytically about the original lattice model. And basically there's a phase transition at some value of the t's, or equivalently this n tilde. So this is just showing this consistency with what we already know about the analytics of the original model. And so now we look at non-zero z. And so the idea is that if you start at z equals zero in the insulating phase, that is with the TII configured in such a way that you're in the insulating phase, and then you flow with quantum RG, this is what the couplings look like. And so this is this top line is the nearest neighbor coupling. And as you go down, these are the farther and farther couplings. So at z equals zero, you just have the original coupling. And then as you flow to non-zero z, you generate more and more couplings. And this is how the couplings change. And so you can see that as you flow in z, this is a log linear plot. So as you flow in z, the straight line indicates exponential decay in the hopping. And here, if you look at the TIGA for fixed z, as a function of the distance, they're also decaying exponentially because this is linear and a log linear plot, so it's exponential decay. So the hopping fields are decaying in strength in both QRG flow and the lattice distance. And so you can quantify this fragmentation of the lattice via this susceptibility, sum over. It's independent of I because we're assuming the lattice is hypercubic and therefore translationally invariant. And you can see that as you flow in z, the susceptibility decays exponentially. And so there's some scale zf you can set by a decay by a factor of e at which the model becomes fragmented. So this is our phase diagram. So the picture is you start with nearest neighbor couplings. So we're starting here, looking at just this part here. So this is a z equals 0 boundary. This describes the original lattice model. And so you start in this area where the original lattice model is an insulator. You flow in z. For some zf, the tijs are sufficiently small that the space is fragmented. So this is the original nearest neighbor couplings. As you flow, you generate more couplings, which are longer distance. But the couplings are decaying so fast that if you keep flowing in z past this point, the model becomes isolated and fragmented. So now let's see what the QRA, the quantum normalization group flow, looks like from this point, from the superfluid phase. And after some z, all the hoppings merge in this case. And if you look at how they decay as a function of the lattice distance, now, this is a log-log plot. And there's some constant c here, which I subtract out. That's a finite size effect, because you have to do numerics on a finite lattice. And so this is a straight line and a log-log plot. So now the hoppings after some z, so this is after 2.8 and larger, so that's after about this point or so, you get just a power law decay instead of exponential decay. And all the hoppings are the equivalent. So the way to think about this is that if you think of the hoppings as like airports at different sites, all the airports, they merge together here for a sufficiently large z. So it's equally difficult to get to any other site on the lattice. So it's equally difficult from here to here as it is to get from here to here. And you can quantify this by fitting these to a power law. Sorry, to this functional form. So it's exponential decay in z and a power law decay in lattice distance. And if you extract this via fitting, you'll see that this psi, which characterizes exponential decay in z, goes to 0. So the correlation in the real space is like 1 over psi. And if psi is going to 0, that says this little circle is going infinite. So basically, the whole lattice, it's equally easy to get to anywhere else in the lattice. So we say that the model becomes non-local. And so now this is what the phase diagram looks like. So you start in the superfluid phase and you flow, you reach this non-local region.
OK, let's conclude.
Yeah, OK. So that's just from the critical point. This is what the phase diagram looks like. Uh-huh. And so this is basically what the picture. You can think of the volume of the space. The superfluid phase is going to 0. Critical point is going to 0 exponentially. And the insulating phase, it goes to infinite. And so the key idea is that you can use, if you start with a model that you know less about, you don't really understand, so this was an easy model, but if you start with a model you don't understand, do quantum normalization group flow, see what the geometry looks like under that flow, and then you can use that to characterize the phases of the original model on the z equals 0 boundary.
OK, let's thank our speaker.
Yeah. Actually, I
have
lots of questions.
Can
you go back to
the
slide? Oh, yeah. Could you explain this?
Yeah, sorry, I was going pretty fast. Basically, there's from the hopping fields Tij, you can extract a metric that correspond the metric of the corresponding model in terms of on the gravity side. And so if you use that metric to characterize, it looks something like this. So this is z is the quantum RG flow. And these are the coordinates of the lattice model. So this is basically controlling, this function f is basically controlling the volume of the lattice model at different z. And if you can get this from the Tij. And so basically it's saying if you start at different phases, this is how the volume changes. So in the superfluid phase, the volume goes to 0 because the hoppings are becoming equal to any site. So the effective volume of the lattice is going to 0. At the critical point, I skipped that because we ran out of time. But in the insulating phase, the hoppings are all going to 0. So every site is isolated. And it's an infinite. In the thermodynamic limit, the lattice is infinite, so you get an infinite effective volume.
So here we do a calculation. You just keep the neighboring hoppings, so you just is this a schematic
Yeah, it's a bit schematic, but there's only nearest neighbor hopping that z equals 0. As you flow in z, you get more hoppings are generated.
Yeah, right, right. But when you do a computation, you assume that one is the one, like the nearest neighbor hopping.
As it equals zero.
Oh, no. At, when you calculate, calculate that FC.
When you calculate what? TI?
Oh, no, FC.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
no,
yeah.
Yeah.
When
so
you
only consider like the nearest neighbor hopping, right? Where you do this thing. Or like.
At zero. So I'm not understanding your question. There's only beyond the z equals zero, the UV boundary, there are more hoppings, more connections.
I was wondering, like, how do you calculate this FC?
So this is why I don't understand very well, but I can sketch what I know. Basically, you pick two sites on the lattice, Tij, and you expand the hopping around this link. So you get something like T0 plus D mu, D nu, Tij, and so on. So these coefficients, so the second order term, those turn out to be the metric. And so that's essentially how it's calculated, but it's not, it's actually, there needs to be work done on this area because calculating these is sensitive to the original mass you choose for the lattice model. So there's no, you would want the metric that you flow into to be independent of that, so they're still working on how to calculate this in a way that's not sensitive to the original mass. But this is roughly how you get it. And these correspond to the, so this is where the higher spin gauge theory comes in. So these correspond to the fields with spin one, spin two, and so on. And you're only getting, I think, this is what I think. I think you're only getting integer spins because you start with the bosonic model. But these correspond, and you get more spin three field and so on.
OK, let's wrap up. And thank Gabe once again.